sorry.
I'd like to bring to order the House Committee on Business and Labor, and we've got a few things left on our agenda to deal with today. And we're going to start out by opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 279A.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this is the bill that you started the public hearing last week and did not finish. It requires the employee's notice of non-payment of wages and compensation to the employer that it include a statement of the payment of unpaid wages and compensation paid within 12 days of receiving notice will cap the penalty at 100% of the unpaid wages. And I do not believe the amendment is of interest anymore, so I will not describe it, the A2 amendment.
Okay.
Yeah. It's on OLIS, but it was no longer of interest, my opinion.
So with that, we are going to have to move through this and try to keep our comments short, but I'm going to call up Nancy Fabell and David Tilton.
This is our last committee. Maybe our last committee.
I don't know.
Focused on a couple.
And so, welcome to the committee. I introduce yourself before you give your testimony and try to keep it concise because we do have a few other things on the agenda as well. So,
Chair Hulvey, members of the committee. My name is Nancy Fabell. I'm the owner of the Sourdough Bakery in Winchester Bay. We are a microbusiness, having as few as 3 employees in the off-season, up to maybe 10 in the full season. We provide year-round good jobs at considerably more than minimum wage with benefits. Hillary Clinton's recent commencement speech at Wellesley affirmed for me the reason I am here today. She encouraged her audience to get involved, speak up when things are wrong, get to know your representatives, and get involved in the political process. I have a little experience with this. I was able to get a local ordinance overturned that disallowed the public from using a limited food service business's restrooms. It's an interesting thing to tell your customers that the reason they can't use your restroom is that there is a local ordinance against it, and I am proud to have played a leading role in getting this ordinance rescinded. It took 9 months of lobbying, letter writing, and protesting, but it was worth it. Coming back to the present, my current situation has been resolved. It was found that my employee was not due any overtime wages, as she was determined to be a salaried employee in agreement with how we were paying her. It's easy to go back to work and wash my hands of this and push this situation back into a corner, but to me, the fundamental problem still exists, and I feel compelled to speak up in spite of the cost and time involved to travel here today. I am the first to condemn those employers who take unfair advantage of their employees. It makes doing business harder for me, knowing my labor costs are higher than those who don't pay their employees what they have earned and are rightfully entitled to. As I'd mentioned in my earlier testimony in front of the Senate committee, I was more than happy to allow the process to continue through Boley, who I believe would have also decided in my favor. If the legislature wants to allow a mechanism by which cases can be withdrawn from the process, that's fine, but there can't be such a strong incentive to do so. I have a redacted copy of a letter that is being actively used to solicit employees away from the Boley process. How can an honest employer stand a chance against this? The state of Oregon has some great programs to encourage business development and to encourage businesses to relocate and expand here. But this labor issue completely negates Oregon's attempts to create an environment where small business can flourish. I believe it is a great injustice to employers in this state to have to operate in a climate where this can happen. Small business is the backbone of a state's economy and needs a level playing field. Further, this situation disproportionately punishes small and micro businesses like mine. We do not have separate accounting divisions and separate HR departments like larger companies, and mistakes can be made a lot more easily when payroll is processed by hand. One of the big reasons I elected to fight this wage claim was because of the effect it would have on the rest of my employees if everyone knew that they could collect $14,000 in severance pay on their way out the door. Google has a program where they offer their new hires $3,000 if they will quit before their training program starts. This is to weed out employees who don't really want to be there before they spend a lot of money onboarding them. For me, not fighting this claim would be the equivalent of offering $14,000 as a quit incentive, and that's something, frankly, a lot of people would accept. It's also something that if Google can't afford to do, small businesses can't afford to do either. There are some dishonest employers out there, but there are already mechanisms in place to punish and discourage this type of behavior. To have in place a unilateral mechanism that works to grant employees thousands of dollars for wage disputes with no downside if they lose just lays the groundwork for frivolous lawsuits. Anyone can make a mistake with payroll. When I look at the mistakes that are made in business every day, it is apparent how easy it is to make mistakes. An order I placed for my business 2 weeks before Memorial Day for inventory was accidentally not filled, and we went into the holiday weekend with insufficient inventory, which cost us hundreds of dollars in lost sales. This was due to a mistake by highly paid employees at a huge multi-million dollar corporation with hundreds of employees and dozens of fail-safe policies to prevent such an eventuality. When an ex-employee can manipulate the system to turn a payroll error into a $14,000 windfall, there is something wrong with the system. In our case, it was not a payroll error, but a payroll dispute, which we won, but the problem is still there. Under current law, plaintiff's attorneys are soliciting potential clients because they know they can get away with sending demand letters for thousands of dollars without informing employers of the 12-day window to pay the back wages and smaller 12-day penalty. The reason SB 279 helps address this practice is that it removes some of the financial incentives for a plaintiff's attorney to always seek the much larger penalty of 30 days' wages, attorney's fees, etc. Chair Hovey, members of the committee, I'm asking you today to move the A. Engross bill that passed in the Senate on a unanimous vote to the floor of the House of Representatives. Thank you for your time and consideration today.
Thank you. Do you have any testimony to give?
Yes. Thank you, Chair Hovey, members of the committee. My name is David Tilton, and I'm an attorney from Coos Bay, and have been practicing law, including employment law, since graduating from Lewis and Clark Law School in 1984. I worked for the local legal aid office for 12 years prior to going into private practice in 1996. I've been litigating wage claims cases for almost my entire career, and the majority of time I am on the employee's side. I decided to go to law school after being laid off from my job with the railroad during the economic slump of 1979, and was a proud member of the Brotherhood of Railroad Signalmen with no negotiated recall rights long enough that I was actually called back to work after I'd been practicing law for approximately 18 months. Obviously, I didn't go. I am one of the few attorneys who practices in the Coos Bay area, representing primarily employees in employee-employer matters, and I was also the Democratic candidate for House District 1 in 2002. During my initial stint in college, prior to serving in the military, I worked for the airlines and was a member of the Teamsters Union. And I respectfully submit that being a strong labor advocate and also litigating employee rights cases primarily on behalf of employees and supporting this bill are not mutually exclusive. Now, historically, until 2001, ORS 652-150 made the employer strictly liable for wage claims. In 2001, the legislature passed House Bill 2867, which enacted Provision 2 of ORS 652.150, which limited the penalty to the amount of an employee's unpaid wages or compensation, in addition to the wages themselves, if the employee or someone on behalf of the employee, usually an attorney, failed to submit a written notice of non-payment to the employer, and the employer subsequently failed to pay the disputed wages within 12 days. As a plaintiff's attorney, I amended my demand letter to so state, and sometimes the employers that I send my demand letters to actually pay the disputed wages and the penalty, and when that happens, I simply don't get the attorney's fees. I've actually had a case or two where the unpaid wages amounted to somewhere in the neighborhood of 60, 70, 80 bucks. My retainer allows me 25% of the recovery if litigation is not filed, and I've actually received such huge sums as $13 when the employer has responded timely responded to my demand by paying. Now, in Ms. Faubel's case, my answer to the lawsuit was that the notice which had been sent by opposing counsel did not inform the employer that the potential liability would be limited if she paid the disputed wages. However, that issue was never decided by the arbitrator in her case because we prevailed for the most part on the merits of the case. The fact was that the individual involved was a supervisor and administrative employee and therefore was exempt with regard to the payment of overtime. And I remain of the opinion that the notice requirements of House Bill 2867 from 2001 require that the demand letter advise the employer of that fact. And had I not prevailed on the merits of Ms. Faubel's case, it's very likely that I would have appealed the case to the Oregon Court of Appeals relying on the legislative history of House Bill 2867. I reviewed it. I reviewed all the testimony, all the written testimony, the hearings like we are today, and would have asked that any attorney fees and penalty wages been stricken from any judgment. The sole purpose of Senate Bill 279 is to simply clarify the intent of the 2001 legislature requiring the employer to be put on notice of the ramifications of not paying all wages due upon termination of employment, and nothing more. Such notice would have allowed Ms. Faubel to respond to opposing counsel's demand letter with our allegations, which were proven that the individual in Ms. Faubel's case was a supervisor as well as an administrative employee. Now, briefly, with regard to the willfulness elements of the statute, the Oregon Supreme Court has defined the term willfully very broadly, stating, and I quote, "In civil cases, the word willful, as ordinarily used in courts of law, does not necessarily imply anything blamable or any malicious or wrong toward the other party or perverseness or moral delinquency, but merely that the thing done or admitted to be done was done or admitted intentionally. It amounts to nothing more than this, that the person knows what he is doing, intends to do what he is doing, and is a free agent." I want to briefly address some of the written testimony that was provided on May 24th. First of all, I have no problem with the testimony of my friend and former colleague, Michael Dale. Mr. Dale and I worked for Oregon Legal Services for many years, which was the legal aid which covered rural Oregon. And I never held it against him that he was management when I was president of the union. However, I think it needs to be made clear that the penalties referenced at paragraph 3 at page 2 of his written testimony would not be limited only to the amount of unpaid wages, but the unpaid wages themselves are actually allowed. So what we're talking about is you get the unpaid wages no matter what, and the penalty is limited to the amount of the unpaid wages. That can be somewhat substantial when you're talking about overtime or something like that. It can also be minuscule in the cases that I've just related to you. And I think that it was unclear from the written testimony, but I think Mr. Dale would agree with me on that point. With regard to the testimony of Mr. Towers, the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, attorney's fees are not recoverable in wage claims cases by an employer who prevails, which is why it is seen as quite harsh by employers and why the notice should inform an employer of the potential ramifications of not paying those wages. Finally, I concur completely with the opinion of Legislative Counsel Dexter Johnson, rendered on May 18th of this year. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Barreto.
No, I don't have a question, but I just wanted to thank you for coming all the way up from Coos Bay to testify.
Thank you very much for making the effort to come here and present your bill. Appreciate it.
It's a nice drive.
It's a nice day for a drive. Up next, let's have Art Towers and Michael Dale.
Good Chair Hovey, members of this committee, my name is Michael Vale. I'm the Executive Director of the Northwest Worker Justice Project. I'm here testifying on behalf of the Oregon Coalition to Stop Wage Theft. You've heard from me before during this session. You've heard me talk about what a problem wage theft is, and we came forward with suggestions about how to make it more possible for workers to get represented in order to be able to collect their wages in what is a scenario of basically a massive amount of non-payment wages. The committee was unable to move most of those proposals, and it is what it is. This bill is a step in the wrong direction. It's a step backwards to make it more difficult. And I want to explain why, but before I do, I want to correct a couple of things in the testimony just heard. One is on the question of willfulness to be held responsible for penalty damages. I don't have any quarrel with Dave. Dave's a good friend and an old friend, a good lawyer, and I don't want to quarrel with him. But his quotations from the Oregon Supreme Court were accurate, but think about it. If the problem is a mistake, that is not something you did consciously and intentionally. And the only way you're going to be liable for penalties for a mistake is if after the mistake is brought to your attention, you fail to correct the mistake. Otherwise, it's clearly not willful, and therefore no penalties are even due. The second problem that comes out of Dave's testimony is illustrated by his talking about the attorney's fees that he earns in many cases that he sends this notice and people respond and he gets $20. It's very noble and generous of Dave to do that, but I would tell you that his expense in collecting that $20 is far, far in excess of $20. And lawyers, particularly single practitioner lawyers in small towns, new lawyers who are starting into business, they're small business people too, and they can't afford to be handling cases where they're not going to receive any kind of compensation commensurate with their costs. And the way that comes into play is if a worker comes to them and says, I want to collect my wages, you ask them, have you sent a notice? You know that if you take the case, you spend an hour or two with the client, understand the problem, your staff sets up a file, it goes on your malpractice insurance, and you basically assume responsibility for the case. If you write the letter, then what's going to happen is that if the employer pays, it's good for the client, they get paid, it's good for the employer because they settle up, but it's not good for the lawyer. Now, some private attorneys, some noble ex-legal aid lawyers like Dave Tilton may be willing to accept cases on that basis. I submit to you that most people, most small business people starting out in a practice, in a small practice, are not going to be able to do that, and they'll just simply say, I'm sorry, I can't help you. You should write a letter. If they don't pay at the end of the 12 days, come back and see me. And so that's a problem generally with this statute. The statute is what it is. I'm not here to argue that it should be changed, but it gets more difficult with this statute. And again, I'll try to briefly explain why. It is strange indeed that given that most people will not have the assistance of a lawyer in preparing their claim, that my day laborer client who has maybe 4 years of education, does not speak or read or write English, is called upon to advise his employer about what the law is just to protect his wages. That's wrong. Now, most people would say that, well, he'll have an attorney. Well, that's not necessarily so. But if he has an attorney, then it calls upon an attorney to make a statement to the defendant about the defendant's potential liability, which is not even true. It is an erroneous statement. There are circumstances, like with prior offenders, where actually if you pay within 12 days, you still have to pay penalties. And then what happens if you've advised them that the penalty, that if you pay within within 12 days, your penalties won't be any greater? I suggest that there might be liability against the attorney. In any event, there's going to be a lot of anger and legitimate concern. That's why it's better when we're dealing with questions of law for people to be advised by their own attorney about what their potential liabilities are, and that's a better way for it to go. Now, we don't like this bill at all. Turning the corner there, Mr.
Turning the corner, you should wrap it up.
That's what I'm doing. We have said that we would accept compromises in any of two ways. One is that people should have notice of the law, everybody should have notice of the law, and if we want to put it on posters or give it notices somehow that the state provides, we're fine with that. The second thing is we're actually okay with the idea of the attorney if the person's represented by an attorney being required to provide the notice, provided that the notice was corrected to be a correct statement of the law, number one. Number two, that the attorney is relieved of any civil liability for misadvising based upon a mandatory notice. And number three, it must be clear that if a worker has perfected a notice and then later is forced to go back and get an attorney, that the attorney does not then have to give the notice anew and start the 12-day period running again. Thank you.
Thank you. Can introduce yourself for the record, and then we'll get to questions.
Excuse me, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. My name is Arthur Towers with the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. I want to start by saying we're really sympathetic to very small business owners who have a lot of employment law to grapple with as they start hiring workers. One thing that is a secret of mine that I hope you won't share with anybody is that I owned a small business for 8 years. And I, looking back on it now, I would bet a nickel or maybe two that I broke some rules and did some things wrong because I didn't know employment law well enough to know what the heck I was doing. But that said, it was my responsibility to understand the law and take responsibility for it if I did make a mistake. It's not fair for business owners to rely on employees seeking their final paycheck or other outstanding wages to provide that education. Again, my basic take on this is that we have small business owners that hire a small number of people or hire seasonally or whatever, trying to figure out what to do and want to do the right thing. We have employees that just want to get their final paycheck or their vacation pay or whatever that might be, and neither one of them has, you know, a terrible amount of resources or a large amount of resources to understand the nuance of employment law. So we'd recommend an approach that calls on state agencies that have regular contact with small business owners to include that information in their regular communications. If the legislature decides that this 12-day notice rises to that level, then go for it. It's the right thing to do. And you've done that with issues like minimum wage, domestic violence, harassment on the job, worker safety, and a bevy of other things. I included in testimony, I hope I made it on OLIS here, like the samples of posters that I found by doing copious research by going to the copy room in my own office and pulling the posters off the wall. But that gives you a sense of what the different possibilities are. But it could also be email blast trainings. It could be on the back of tax forms or through other types of regular communication. We think that that approach would raise the level of awareness for small employers while not putting it on, you know, somebody, the sort of worker that Mr. Dale described. I want to just wrap up by adding one level of nuance here regarding the testimony that took place in the Senate. We went back and did some of the research, and I just did want to point out that worker involved in that case brought a number of different wage claims against the employer. And they lost a lot, but they did win one, so it wasn't completely nonsensical for them to go forward. So I'll leave it right there and happy to answer questions.
Questions, Representative Evans.
I better not ask my question. Thank you.
Other questions, Representative Fahey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. this question possibly for Mr. Towers. Do you know if there's any other areas of law where an employee is expected to notify the employer of the employer's responsibilities? Sorry to be
not, Chair Holvey, Representative Fahey. Why did I get put on the spot?
Sorry.
It's okay. The deal is nothing I could think of off the top of my head. I'm sure that there may be, but I just don't know one way or the other.
Other questions?
Sorry. I'll try to find out.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And up last on this bill, Paloma Sparks.
Good afternoon, for the Chair Holvey, members of the committee. For the record, Paloma Sparks, the Bureau of Labor and Industries. Some of our concerns have already been stated by Mr. Towers and Mr. Dale. My primary concern is that an employee could accidentally waive their rights by not knowing the exact words to put in a notice. I think requiring that of an attorney or requiring it of the agency is a perfectly reasonable requirement, but I'm concerned that an employee just wouldn't know enough to have to put that information in a notice, and they have then waived their rights going forward.
Thank you. Questions for the Bureau of Labor and Industries? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Jen, could you now tell us a little bit about the Dash 2?
Yes, Mr. Chair, committee member. The Dash 2 was discussed in the last meeting, and that is the amendment that would require an attorney who is representing the worker. When they send the letter to the employer, they would have to include that notice to the employer about the penalty cap if they pay within the 12 days. And it also required the attorney to send a copy of that letter to BOLI, and BOLI would create a searchable, publicly available database of these types of notices to employers.
Thank you. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 279, and we will move on. Committee, it'll be my intent to move this bill to rules. I think there's a little bit more work to do on this as far as an amendment that I had heard was being worked on, and so there's some communication that needs to be continued. And I would like to see some sort of resolution to this bill, so I'm not prepared to pass the bill as is or with the amendment at this point. And given that there's actually four of us at this particular committee that are also on the Rules Committee. It'll bring a little bit of flavor to that Rules Committee for continuing this discussion. And so I will be looking for a motion to move the bill to Rules.
Did I hear you open a work session?
Not yet.
You will.
With that, I'm going to open the work session on Senate Bill 279.
Yeah. Chair Holby, I move Senate Bill 279 without recommendation to the Committee on Rules.
Mm-hmm. Representative Barreto moves Senate Bill 279A without recommendation to the Committee on Rules. Is there discussion? Representative Bynum.
Chair Holby, I just want to put on the record that I am absolutely sympathetic to the small business owners' concerns. Many people feel that it is a level playing field, or actually a not-so-level playing field, where the employer has more power than they actually have. As a small business owner, you do not know all of the rules, and you generally don't act with bad intentions. Likewise, there are too many opportunities for wage theft to occur in the state, and I think that the state should take a strong stand on people who are committing this against employees. They deserve their pay when they earn it, according to the rules that the pay schedule that the employer set up in the beginning. So I hope that this comes to a resolution, but I think that small businesses deserve a much fairer shake than they're getting in these conversations.
Thank you, Representative Barreto.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I would concur with what Representative Bynum said, and really thought that this bill could have been moved out of here without the amendment and would have done justice to employers around the state. But since it will be in Rules, we will continue to try and pass it as is down there.
Other discussion? Well, I certainly can appreciate the concern for fairness, but I also think about the fairness for the employee as well. So I don't think we've quite reached a good outcome yet, so I'm hoping we will. So with that, Kayla, can we have a roll call on the motion?
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
Yes.
Representative Fahey?
Aye.
Representative Pack?
Aye.
Representative Hurd?
Aye.
Representative Kenemer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barreto?
Aye.
Vice Chair Bynum?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. Senate Bill 279 received the required votes, is passed to the Committee on Rules, and we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 279. And let's open a work session on Senate Bill 974A, vehicle dealers.
Mr. Chair and committee members.
Well, should we try a different bill?
Yes, sorry. Oh, that's disconcerting. Is it here? Here we go. I'm sorry. Mr. Chair, committee members, the committee heard this bill on May 8th. It increases the bond or the letter of credit for vehicle dealers. For those dealers who deal primarily in motorcycles, ATVs, snowmobiles, increases that bond requirement from $2,000 to $10,000, and it prohibits non-retail customers from making a claim related to the motorcycle, the moped, the ATV, the snowmobile. It also increases the bond for vehicle dealers, what we think of the car dealers, from the current $40,000 to $50,000, and allows non-retail customers to claim up to $10,000 of that if they are a vehicle dealer in Oregon or they are licensed in another state with a similar bond or letter of credit requirement. Prohibits ODOT from issuing any new dealer certificate for those people who deal exclusively in motorcycles. The Dash 4 amendment that is before you prohibits the vehicle dealer who holds that certificate for the motorcycles, mopeds, ATVs, and snowmobiles from making a claim against the vehicle dealer's bond or the letter of credit.
prohibits ODOT from issuing new dealer certificates for persons who deal exclusively in motorcycles, mopeds, ATVs, and snowmobiles. So it expanded it. The original bill just mentioned motorcycles, but they're talking about no new dealer certificates for those who deal exclusively in motorcycles, mopeds, ATVs, and snowmobiles. The A4 amendment has a minimal expenditure impact and no revenue impact.
Thank you. So, do we have a motion?
Chair Hobie, I move to adopt the A4 amendment to Senate Bill 974A.
Representative Barreto moves to adopt the A4 amendment to Senate Bill 974A. Is there discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, the amendment is adopted.
Chair Hovey, I move Senate Bill 974A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barreto moves Senate Bill 974A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none, Kayla, could we have a roll call?
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
Yes.
Representative
Gagey?
Aye.
Representative Pack?
Aye.
Representative Kern?
Aye.
Representative Henneberg?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barreto?
Aye.
Vice Chair Bynum?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. Senate Bill 974A, I'm going to receive the votes, has passed. Rep. Evans, you want to carry this one?
Yes, sir. Sure.
With that, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 974A. Let's stand at ease for a moment.
Did you have me? My sister says you can go get stuff for me.
Let's reconvene, and I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 984A.
Mr. Chair and committee members, committee has not had a public hearing on this measure. It's a measure that requires employers and industries subject to statutes requiring overtime pay for work exceeding maximum statutory hours in any one day to calculate the employee's overtime on a daily and a weekly basis and to pay the greater amount of those amounts. Defines week as any consecutive 168-hour period, creates a private right of action, and authorizes the court to award costs, disbursements, and attorney fees to the prevailing party for violations of overtime requirements. No amendment before you.
So, committee, this particular bill, we have not had a hearing on. It came over from the Senate with a caveat that there was an agreement between stakeholders. That agreement is still under discussion, and we haven't quite got there yet. I've been requested to send this to rules so that this topic can be finished around overtime. And so I don't have much more than that. I'm going to send it without I would prefer to send this without recommendation to the Committee on Rules. So that will be the motion.
Chair Holby, I move Senate Bill 984 without recommendation to the Committee on Rules.
Representative Bynum moves Senate Bill 984 without recommendation to the Committee on Rules. Discussion. Representative Evans.
I think it's a good idea to send it to rules. They don't have enough to do.
Yeah.
I'm very excited. Yep. I like this motion.
As a rules member.
Yeah.
Representative Barreto.
This seemed like a very simple bill and a simple fix to some confusion, I think, on Bowley's part. So what more needs to be done on the bill, I guess?
Well, it's my understanding that there was an agreement between AOI, the AFL, and a few others on other pieces of that bill that ended up not fitting into the relating to clause, and Senator Knope and Senator Taylor sent the bill over with this directive of an agreement to be put together. That's what we were working on, and it's been moving extremely slowly. So I, you know, was hoping that we would have got to a point where we, this agreement could have happened before now, but it has not. Okay. So that's where we're at.
Thank you for the explanation.
So the motion is on the table. And any other discussion? Seeing none, Kayla, could we have a roll call, please?
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
Yes.
Representative Fahey?
Aye.
Representative Hack?
Aye.
Representative Hurd?
Aye.
Representative Penimer?
Excused.
Vice Chair Barreto?
Aye.
Vice Chair Bynum?
Aye.
Chair Holdy?
Aye. Senate Bill... 984, having received the votes, is passed to the Committee on Rules. And we will open a, close that work session on Senate Bill 984 and open a work session on Senate Bill 299A.
Mr. Chair and committee members, you heard this bill last week. It's the bill that clarifies that the employer may limit the employee to accruing 40 hours of sick time per year. It made other changes to the sick time provisions. The dash A4 amendment was adopted last week. It defines substantial ownership at 15%, and there's no revenue or expenditure impacts on that A4 amendment.
Thank you. And Representative Barreto, would you like to make a motion on this bill to the floor?
Yeah. Chair Holby, I move Senate Bill 299A
as amended
to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barreto moves Senate Bill 299A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Seeing none, Kayla, could we have a roll call, please?
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative
Evans? Yes.
Representative
Fahey?
Aye.
Representative Hack?
Aye.
Representative
Hurd? Aye. Representative
Penimer?
Excused.
Vice Chair Barreto?
Aye.
Vice Chair Bynum?
Aye.
Chair
Holby? Aye. Senate Bill 299A has passed and moves to the floor. And Carrier on this one. Representative Barreto. Still carry this bill. And with that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 299A. And we will open a work session on Senate Bill 901A.
Mr. Chair, committee members, you heard this bill May 3rd. It is a bill that exempts amateur athletes from certain specified employment regulations. No amendment today, minimal expenditure impact, minimal revenue impact.
So I know that there were some questions remaining on this bill, and Tim, I guess you're the lucky one here. And I know Representative Fahey had a question and Representative Doherty had a question. So whichever one would like to go first.
Representative Doherty. Oh, okay. Thank you. Thank you very much for doing this. I asked you a little bit ahead of time. Looking at this bill, and I understand, you know, the situations with at least in this case of the Winterhawks, that they're, you know, living with other people and they're, you know, minors and so on. But the one concern that I had with us exempting them from everything was dealing with employment conditions. And usually employment conditions are things like making sure that they get breaks, making sure that they get lunch breaks, that there are safety things in place. You know, that if you know, somebody's really sick, that they don't have to go out and on the ice, even though realizing the sense that a 16-year-old kid would want to go out on the ice and play and so on. So what my concern, I guess my question is if this legislation is enacted, are there or will there be policies in place that deal with what I would consider health and safety and employment conditions, making sure that they do get breaks, that, you know, there is some sort of I'm not going to say sick leave because they don't get paid, but some sort of sick, all of those kind of things that deal with the health and safety of the employee. And that's my question. Yeah,
Chair Holvey, Representative Doherty. Again, for the record, Tim Bernasek with the Portland Winterhawks and Western Hockey League. The Winterhawks, as far as them in particular, do have extensive health and safety initiatives. I wish Mr. Piper were here to be able to elaborate on those, but there is a lot of care taken for these students. Many of them are at Sunset High School, where there's tutors for them. They have trainers that are on staff to make sure their health and safety needs are met. But one of the things that the bill specifically, and as we talked about before, currently amateur athletes like the Portland Winterhawk players and other amateur athletes are already not covered by employment laws. Mm-hmm. But what we did in this bill is we deferred to the governing amateur bodies that for all amateur sport, because this will be broader than just the Winterhawks. This will be youth basketball, youth football, and those leagues. I can just say from my experience being a coach of a third, fourth, and fifth, sixth football program under USA Football, which is a governing body for the football, mandates certain you have to have a certain number of practices before pads are put on, so you get certain conditioning. There's time limits on practice sessions and things like that. And so the amateur governing bodies that we're making sure have control, if we're talking about amateur athletes, they have to be underneath these, part of a system that is the governing body that does encapsulate many of the health and safety concerns that you're addressing.
Okay, just a follow-up comment.
Follow-up.
And I think it's more of just a comment. I think, and the difference is, and I know that you know, their hearts are in the right place, but the difference is there is money involved, and in other words, you know, a gate to get in play and that, you know, for us to go in and watch them and so on and so forth. So I just want to make sure that those kind of policies and the idea of you know, head traumas, all that kind of thing, are in place. And I guess I kind of sound a little bit like a mother right now, but I think that those are the sort of things that if this bill goes through, I would want to make sure that those sort of policies that do cover what I call kids sports and high school athletics and so on would still be in effect for these amateur athletes.
Chair Holvey, Representative Doherty, and that's right. And I mean, I think maybe a close analogy would maybe be the NCAA situation, where there's, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of revenue in those programs. But mm-hmm. again, there are restrictions on when spring football for Oregon State football and those types of things, and these health and safety initiatives are in place with the winners. I just don't, off the top of my head, know exactly what those are, but it is something that is very important to the league and is in place, whether there's revenue generated at high school, college level, or even at the youth level.
Okay, fine. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Fahey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm just, in terms of the language of the bill, the key part of the bill references national governing bodies of amateur sports. And so I just did, you know, we had a little conversation, I did a little research, and it sounds like there's 39 national governing bodies for Olympic sports, USA archery, USA badminton. Are there non-Olympic national governing bodies, or are those 39 bodies the national governing bodies that would be applicable in this instance in the law?
Yeah, Chair Holvey, Representative Fahey. Yeah, and as I after we spoke, I looked at the bill a little bit, trying to jog my memory. And when we originally proposed this bill, as you may recall, there's a current exemption in the work comp statutes that were written decades ago that talked, and it was aimed at this exact situation, as Winterhawk players, and it talked about declared an amateur athlete by the U.S. Olympic Committee or the Canadian Olympic Committee. And probably in that time, the hockey players were United States and Canada. What we realized as we were looking at this, the Legislative Council said, you know, we probably need to, for your bill or not, we need to dust up and clean up this exemption, because a lot of the players of the Winterhawks are now coming from other nations. And so the thought was, well, and there was a question about whether the U.S. and Canadian Olympic committees still technically declare amateur athletes, because a number of basketball and hockey, for example, they have NBA and NHL players playing there. So in addition to saying, well, let's go ahead and we'll well, keep, we want to do as minimal change as possible. So let's keep that U.S. Olympic Committee and the Olympic Committee, but then also expand it internationally because there are European players and others coming in. But then in addition, we wanted to say, well, what about amateur athletes generally? And that's the second part, registering with a recognized national governing body or its state affiliate. So those could potentially be broader than, I'm not familiar with all of the 39 official Olympic amateurs, but well, let's use, I'm guessing here a little bit, but the one I am more familiar with was USA football. That is not an Olympic sport, at least not yet. But yet that is the recognized governing body of amateur football, and so that would capture those groups. And in working with MLAC and others, we spent a lot of time making sure that we got this balance, I think, correct. So that's, I hope that addresses your question, but that's really what we're trying to do is just get our arms around what was existing in statute that maybe didn't really reflect the current state of affairs anyway that needed to be cleaned up, right, and then applying that to the employment statutes.
Follow up.
Thank
you, Mr. Chair. So what kind of criteria does an individual have to fit to be able to register with one of these national governing bodies? I mean, could I register with USA Archery? I mean, what kind of threshold do I have to pass to be someone who can register with that national governing body?
Chair Holby, Representative Fahey, you mean as an individual who wants to play archery?
Well, an individual can register as an amateur athlete with a recognized national governing body. So it sounds like from the bill, the individual could be declared an amateur athlete by a national governing body, or the individual could register with the national governing body.
Yeah, Chair Holby, Representative Fahey, I think the key there is registering with, so whatever the amateur archery body is that is the recognized, and it's recognized through the, it's called, I think, the Ted Stevens Olympic and Amateur Athlete Act is the overall federal law that sets this up. So I think the way it works is you would sign up with whatever the USA Archery program is or whatever and be, you know, fall under their league, then you would then be registered with the governing body, the archery, USA Archery or whatever it is, that would fall under this provision.
Okay. One last. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I looked at that Ted Stevens Act, and it defines amateur athlete as an athlete who meets the eligibility standards established by the national governing body for the sport in which the athlete competes. So why, so that's the federal definition, and it sounds like the definition we're proposing is a little different from that. Do you have, in your conversations about how to define amateur athlete in this bill, did you look at the federal definition or talk to me about how those relate?
Chair Holby, Representative Fahey, what we did is we looked at what are, for example, I was focusing on USA Hockey, which is the USA, it's Hockey Canada is the equivalent in Canada. Those are the bodies that are the governing amateur sport from the Winterhawks down to, there's a United States Hockey League that's active in the Midwest that operates very similar to the Western Hockey League, to midget and bantam leagues that are 13, 14-year-olds, and they are all registered with USA Hockey, just like the Winterhawks. The Western Hockey League and the Winterhawks are under Hockey Canada and USA Hockey because so much of Western Hockey League is both Canada and the United States. So, again, I'm not sure I'm directly answering your question, but that's the analysis that we did. And then looking at how does this, our understanding was that there are these other, again, USA football, USA basketball, other bodies that are the recognized certifier of amateur athletics. The idea would be that we have some control over who is an amateur, trying to define what is an amateur athlete. We know the Winterhawks players are, we know high school football players are and others, but it was how do we encapsulate what is already the current practice and define it and then move it over? And that was the analysis that we did.
I really appreciate that. I think I know more about amateur athletics now than...
Thank you. But to follow up on what her Representative Fahey's questions were, so this bill, this law, is just handing over to these associations or groups of sports advocates who basically by the athlete declaring that I'm an amateur, that's how we define amateur athletics, instead of having actually some sort of definition of what an amateur athlete is versus what an employee is. Is there a consistent criteria or definition for amateur athletes in all of these? Because I know we have some leagues that are farm teams, and I would venture that the Winterhawks is a farm team essentially for the NHL, potentially. And we have some of those farm teams that are semi-pro that aren't amateur, and some are amateur. And so it seems to be there isn't a lot of consistency in the industry on this question. But at the same time, I'm kind of wondering why we would allow a bunch of unknown organizations to basically declare people athletes, and we're going to put codify that in statute and say, this industry can declare their people as amateur athletes and therefore are not subject to wage and hour law, as opposed to letting the wage and hour law itself make that determination of whether somebody is an employee or not. So this seems to me to be getting the, sort of a preemptive approach to taking somebody's potential rights away as having the law determine whether or not they're an employee.
Well, Chair Horby, if I can respond, I mean, when you're talking about farm teams, the farm teams that I'm aware of are like the Salem Volcanoes those are professional athletes. They are affiliated with a major league baseball club. They are paid. That's a separate, I mean, that really is
right.
Different.
But to follow up, I did a little bit of research and found that many of the teams in the Western Hockey League are exactly that, are farm teams for NHL teams.
Chair Holby, actually, no, they're not. They are not. The NHL does recruit from the Western Hockey League teams, the U.S. Hockey League teams, just like they do. There's a draft that's mm-hmm. not too dissimilar from the college football or college basketball drafts. That's a closer analogy than mm-hmm. a farm team on a baseball team. Those players have all been drafted by a major league
right.
club, and they're back at the farm team level. So there is a real distinction there. I think that what we're doing in the bill is there is a system of amateur athletics in this country, and I don't know all the ins and outs of the Ted Stevens
right.
Olympic and Amateur Athletic Act, but there, again, Representative Fahey discussed provisions of that, and there is a certain organizations have been affiliated with as the amateur body, and there are rules and regulations to be registered and affiliated with. So it's not really a system where any one of us could just decide, oh, I'm an amateur athlete and move ahead. We would need to be affiliated and part of an organization, a league, USA Hockey, USA Football, whatever that may be, that is the certifying amateur sport as opposed
to
professional sports.
But my question is, what criteria do they use to declare their organization as amateurs?
Yeah, and Chair Holby, I don't know the ins and outs of how all that works. I just know that they are there. And so there are, there are some distinctions. Again, the farm team, the professional versus what is truly amateur athletics. And that's what we're getting at this bill, is just defining what currently exists and what is the current status that amateur athletes from high school football, high school basketball, high school track players, hockey players, or whatever, are. Nobody would have thought, nor would we have ever come forward with this bill, because amateur athletics, it was understood that these were not employees, but for this lawsuit up in Toronto that has created all these different provinces that have dealt with this, including the state of Washington. And the concern is that if the lawsuit goes the wrong way, which we feel, we hope that we will prevail, the situation for Portland Winterhawks will be either fold up shop here entirely, or I think more than likely they will go to the state of Washington, British Columbia, Nova Scotia, somewhere where this has been dealt with, because that's the way the league is set up. The money is really plowed back into player development, scholarships, and that's what this league is really founded on. And it is, Representative Doherty is correct. I mean, there are, if you've been to a Portland Winterhawk game, there you buy a ticket, you go. It's very high quality athleticism, but it's not too dissimilar from a lot of high school football games, college football, and others. That's what we're dealing with. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, that's why we've come forward. 10 years ago, I don't think anyone would have ever thought to the need for this bill, but for this litigation that's been instituted. And that's why, again, cascading all through Canada and Washington and now Oregon, right, the provincial and state governments are dealing with this issue.
But I go back to my point about, you know, this legislation basically preempting somebody who may feel, in fact, that they are an employee, and then, you know, they're not able to get to that decision because this legislation would preempt them from taking it to court to say, wait a second, the way I'm being paid, the way I'm getting stipends, the way, you know, I'm being treated, the requirements, I could, in fact, be an employee, and I'm going to take you to court to see if I fall under the definition of employee, as opposed to relying on a declaration from what appears to be a group of unknown organizations in the statute declaring that you're an amateur and therefore are not an employee. See, I'm just, you know, it seems sort of backwards at to me personally. I mean, because, you know, we have a definition of employee, and so if the Winterhawks are not treating those kids as employees, that would bear out in an adjudication, as opposed, and at least there's an opportunity for that adjudication. Whereas if we were to pass this, it sort of expands the number of groups from the two Canadian and United States mm-hmm. Olympic committees making this decision to a whole host of associations, athletic associations, that we know nothing about and what their criteria is for establishing those people as amateurs as opposed to employees. And so it just seems like, you know, I need to have a little more definition about what, you know, what the definition between an amateur and an employee, where's that line?
But, Gerald, I don't really have a response to that.
So, and I think there was one other question before I get to Representative Barreto about the disability insurance. If one of these kids were to get hurt and permanently disabled, and I'm not somebody may have gotten the answer to that, but I'm not sure I heard it.
Yes, Chair Holvey, I think that was Representative Bynum's question about what happens. And the WHL policy is there's medical insurance and supplemental insurance for when the students or players are outside of the country that they're covered. There's also a $2 million policy for catastrophic injury that's in place. And then if a player is injured to the extent they cannot, career-ending injury, you may recall from my testimony, every year that a player plays in the Western Hockey League, they get an automatic scholarship that can be used at either college or trade school. That player, regardless of how many years they played, would get the full 4 years scholarship on top of that.
So how much is a scholarship?
It's it depends on which state you're in. It's the equivalent of what it would be to enroll in books mm-hmm. in tuition at Oregon and Oregon State. And then up in Washington, it would be Washington State.
And so that scholarship being remuneration, though, is practiced by schools when they have athletes. They give them scholarships, but the Western Hockey League is not an educational institution, but partners with educational institutions to provide scholarships or pay for the scholarships?
Chair Holvey, what the Western Hockey League does is they provide it. It's different than an NCAA scholarship, which it can be adjusted year in, year out based on performance or academics or whatever. Mm-hmm. This is a guaranteed amount that you get regardless of your performance later. 1 year played, you get that money. You can use it in Oregon. You can use it in any mm-hmm. college or university across the country, or you can apply it to trade school. So there's no partnership necessarily with an individual college. It's just based on the formula is based on the enrollment in that state, right, or I guess province up in Canada.
Yeah, it's just getting, and it's making, anyway, I appreciate your answer to that. I'm not an attorney and wouldn't be in a situation to determine whether that scholarship actually constitutes remuneration and therefore wages, and the person could be considered an employee at that point, and that's why I'm nervous about going down this road with this particular bill, because of that, for me personally. But was there any other questions for?
I have some comments, but I'll wait till we vote.
Okay, well, I'm going to stand at ease for a moment here. I'm going to reopen the committee, House Committee on Business and Labor. And I am going to close the work session on Senate Bill 901A. And that's done.
And this is a not.
Yeah. We're going to send it to rules instead?
No.
It's already closed. With that, I'll close the House Committee on Business and Labor. Business and Labor. With that, I'll close the House Committee on Business.